Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello. So this week, James, we are discussing indie romance, Fingernails, Backpacking Nightmare, The Royal Hotel, Rites of Passage, Malia Style, in How to Have Sex, and swimming biopic, Naiad, plus raunchy high school comedy, Bottoms. But before we get onto those, what else have you been watching this week or doing?
It's such a packed week and we can't fit everything in. I watched Quiz Lady,
yes,
which is also coming out this week, so we could do like a miniature review now.
Yeah, tell me about it.
It's Awkwafina, who I've decided has got the best name in Hollywood, basically. I just love saying that name. And Sandra Oh playing sisters. It's a kind of crazy road movie. Will Ferrell pops up as a quiz master on this TV quiz show. It's kind of mad. There's a sort of hallucinogenic, trippy scene where she's on drugs and is envisaging little clouds in the sky. I quite enjoyed that sequence. It's on Disney Plus, isn't it, I think, coming out. So
yes, it is.
Yeah, I think you can catch it there. I think you have a nice Friday night feeling with it if you watched it. I thought it was quite fun.
Feel good.
Feel good. Yes, exactly. Mm.
Oh, well, we could do with a bit of that in our lives. Yes, I didn't get to it because we got our link to it quite late, I'm afraid. So I didn't get to see it. But I do want to watch that because, if you say Will Ferrell to me, I'm there. I'll watch anything that man does. So I'm totally in. I will definitely watch that. Shall we look at what we can also see this week and kick it off with a bit of a chemistry test with this?
I founded this institute to take the risk out of love. No more uncertainty, no more wondering if you've chosen the right partner, no more divorce. We were the first to build the machines to conduct the test to make the bond of love stronger.
I really want to work here. A lot of famous people study there.
Really? Like who?
Ginger Spice.
She's my favorite.
I know.
So this is Fingernails, and this has been on the sort of film festival circuit, hasn't it, James? Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, it was, I think it kicked off in Toronto. It's written and directed by Christos Nikou, the Greek director who did a film called Apples, which, you know,
was very weird.
Yeah, very weird. Well, you know, they talk about the kind of Greek weird wave of which Yorgos Lanthimos, the director of The Favourite and Killing of a Sacred Deer, is very much a part of. But Christos could probably join that group as well. And this film, I suppose, fits into that. It's his sort of first English language film. Jesse Buckley plays a character called Anna, who is in a relationship with a guy called Ryan, played by Jeremy Allen White, who you'll know from The Bear. I suppose you'd say it's set in it's not exactly a parallel world to our own, but one where there's been a sort of slight technical development where in society, couples can take a test to prove their love for each other. And it's a rather gross and very scientific test. Well, not very scientific, rather gross, where basically they both have each one has a fingernail ripped out.
With no anaesthetic.
No anaesthetic, with pliers, which is... And I have to say, I truly don't like watching fingernails being ripped out when you see it in these kind of torture scenes in movies. It's one of my real, you know, ugh, I will always cover my eyes in those scenes. And this had quite a few of those. Mm. But they then put the two fingernails in a sort of gizmo that looks a bit like a microwave. And then it gives a sort of percentage readout to what their match is. So it's like going on, you know, match.com or something and finding your perfect partner, only you've had to have a fingernail ripped out first of all. Some couples have taken the test. It's not sort of mandatory in this society, but it's something that a lot of people do. I suppose you could say it's a bit like the COVID-19 vaccine. Did you take it or didn't you take it? And those that did take it seem to rather frown on those that didn't. So there's that kind of schism in society. Anna gets a job working at the facility where this test is administered, where she meets Amir, played by Riz Ahmed, and sort of feelings kind of develop between them. But yeah, and you know, the story goes on from there.
Yes. Now, did you like this? Apart from fingernail ripping, which is, as you say, very unpleasant to watch. But it's part of this sort of kooky, sort of lo-fi world that is created by the production, isn't it? Like everyone wears really sort of nerdy jumpers. Everything's beige. Nobody has a mobile phone. that they're sort of landlines and sort of lo-fi record players and things like that. So it's like this alt world, as you said. Did you enjoy spending time in that world?
That's a good question. Yeah, I did enjoy it. It's a strange film. As you say, I think lo-fi is the perfect word. It reminded me, I don't think it's as good as this, because the film I'm about to say is a very good film, but Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which also had that kind of lo-fi tech, in that case, used to wipe people's memories of a relationship. So it's the two feel like sort of spiritual cousins in a way. There's not a huge amount of drama in the film, and I think that's kind of the point. I don't think it's supposed to be. And it does have plenty to say about modern dating and the way so many people rely on, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Match.com, these kind of dating sites, dating apps, algorithms to sort of match people up. You know, that's very different from, I don't know, even 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, where, you know, people would meet normally in a bookshop or a club or a pub or whatever. And that digital dating has changed everything. And this, I suppose, takes it to the extreme where you're willing to have a fingernail ripped out to see if you're right for this person. And of course, the test is complete nonsense, basically. But I do like the way every time they put the two fingernails in the sort of gizmo, it smokes a little bit, like it's burning the fingernails.
Put something too big in the toaster.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was a lovely touch. You know, I think there's some great performances. Luke Wilson also turns up as the guy that runs the facility where Anna and Amir work. So it's a nice cast. I felt it was a little different from everything else that's around at the moment. So I did enjoy it from that point of view. What did you think?
I didn't think it was as much about dating as about the yearning and the what if when you are actually with somebody. And again, I think this is one of those films that it depends where you are in your life and where you are with relationships, what you sort of take from it. But I sort of took from it, it was about being with somebody and thinking, is this the person I stick with? Or do I look again? Like, is there someone else out there that's better matched to me? And then if you're contemplating an affair, which Anna does, is it right? Do you leap out of a relationship that's very comfortable and, as her partner says, it becomes routine and actually works, into the unknown with this other person? And is that just out of the frying pan into the fire, or is that going to make your life so much better because they are the right person and the person you're with was not? So it sort of explores all of those sort of things. And I think the yearning that's done with Jesse Buckley and Riz Ahmed is delightful. I mean, they're just great actors and they can say so much with a look. You know, she watches him dancing at a party and he's dancing like nobody's watching. And the way she looks at him, you just know exactly how she feels about him. And similarly, he sees her singing a song in an office. And again, you can feel that immense connection between them when they don't even touch, really, just very, very brief touches. So I think the way it's done is very lovely, but yeah, it sort of felt weirdly cold and sterile and clinical in a way that the Institute is. And maybe that's the purpose of it. But for me, it didn't really set my heart completely on fire. And I really wanted it to. I wanted there to be a big ending. And there's this whole funny thing of trying to make the subjects go and see romantic movies. So they go and see Hugh Grant rom-coms, don't they? And, you know, watch Notting Hill, which Amir says, you know, movies are ridiculous versions of love. But he says that within a film about love. So it's very knowing and very meta, but in a weird way, a bit too cold for me. Do you agree?
Well, as I said earlier, there's no real drama in it. And it is very low-key. The emotional register is very low-key. It's very lo-fi, as we said. In a way, it probably would have betrayed its essence if there had been some big hearts and flowers ending. Yeah. That's just, I think, the way this director operates. That's his style. So I think he's told the story he wanted to tell in the right way for him, if that makes any sense. It may not appeal to everyone because it isn't a Hugh Grant style romantic comedy, or, you know, it's not Notting Hill. I can't remember, there's a, on the cinema where they go and see the Hugh Grant films, isn't there a tagline that says something like, he knows all about romantic movies or something like that, or he knows all about love? I can't remember what it is, but it was that did make me laugh. It's like, yes, Hugh is the epitome. If you want the answer to romantic love, go and see Four Weddings and a Funeral, basically. Yeah, so it's not going to appeal to everyone, but again, if you want something a little bit off kilter, and Jesse Buckley is perfect for this kind of a film. I mean, obviously, she wasn't in Eternal Sunshine, although I think had she been around, she could have been. But she was in Charlie Kaufman's most recent film, I'm Thinking of Ending Things. And she just seems to fit quirky kind of offbeat stories. And she does it, you know, very subtly. I just think she's an incredibly talented actress, or she's certainly got incredible taste as well. She's, you know, she's worked with some great people. And, you know, Jeremy Allen White, it was great to see him not completely hyper and manic after The Bear, if you've if you've watched that show. So, yeah, it was interesting to see him do something different. So, yeah, there was lots I liked about it, but it won't set your heart on fire, but I don't think it's supposed to.
I did also enjoy seeing Riz Ahmed in a romantic lead as well. I feel like he should do more of that because he is delightful in this. It also reminded me of Foe, the new film with Paul Mescal, that idea of trying to use science to really make your mate the perfect person. And also The Lobster, which, as you mentioned, was Yorgos Lanthimos's film. And this director was actually his second AD. So there is some sort of connective tissue between a sort of Yorgos film and that weird off-kilter, slightly zany world that he creates and this. And so I'm interested to see where he goes from here, because Apples was really quite weird. This is a lot more mainstream compared to that. Maybe the next one will be one that hits just the right, for me anyway, the right mix of off-kilter and really drilling down with an idea and the emotional connection, because that's, I think, what I'm missing here.
Well, it's interesting. This was originally something he was going to do with Carey Mulligan, and then her schedule, I think, on Maestro kind of, you know, made that impossible. On top of that, it's produced by Cate Blanchett and her husband, Andrew Upton. A-list actors are clearly, you know, in love with him. They obviously want to work with him. I don't think that's the problem for him. I think he'll, whatever he writes is going to attract people. It's, as you say, if he wants to make that step just a little bit further up, yeah, it'd be interesting to see how he does it, what he does. He may not want that, you know, that's the interesting thing. I mean, I hope he doesn't take, I don't know, another 4 or 5 years. Obviously, we've had the pandemic, which probably slowed things down. But yeah, you know, I hope he makes something quickly, whatever it is.
Yeah. And it's very accessible because it's here on Apple TV. So you can just watch that when it's out on Friday. You don't have to buy a ticket to the cinema. Just watch it on your box and have a taste of that world. See if you like it. If you do fancy fingernails, it is on Apple TV this Friday. From love to war now, it's This Battle of the Sexes.
They're disgusting.
To do.
That's enough.
Come in, go.
Hi.
We're leaving. We're out.
Where are you gonna go, eh? Bus is not for 2 days.
I'm scared of everyone and everything in this place.
Make what you can. Get on the bus and go.
So this is the Royal Hotel. Where is the Royal Hotel, James?
It's in the middle of nowhere in Australia.
In the middle of nowhere.
In the outback. I've got to say, I didn't know anything about this film really before it started. And with a title like The Royal Hotel...
Did you think you were getting like an upstairs, downstairs type thing?
Yeah, I guess. It's a slightly misleading title initially. And they only really mention the name of the hotel, I think, once or something in the film. Yeah, so it was a little bit disconcerting to suddenly find you in the middle of Australia. It's in a mining town. The basic story is a couple of backpackers. They keep saying they're Canadian. I'm assuming they actually are Canadian, but I thought they were saying at one point very early on, they say, yeah, just say that because people don't like Americans. So maybe they're actually Americans. Anyway, you have Hannah, played by Julia Garner, and Liv, played by Jessica Henwick. Initially, when we meet them, they're in Sydney. They've clearly blown their budget already because one of the girls' credit cards is maxed out. So they get this job in this mining town, working behind the bar at the Royal Hotel, which is, as the lady who gives them the job says, well, you'll have to put up with a little bit of male attention, which is putting it mildly, basically, because there's probably 90% of the residents are, you know, these kind of gruff miners, hardworking, hard drinking. And when they arrive, there's two English girls who've clearly been doing the same job as them on their way out. They're certainly not what I'd call demure English girls. They're on the bar. I'm not even going to say what they're doing on the bar, but Yeah, that was a particularly amusing scene. Running the hotel is a character, a very drunken character played by Hugo Weaving, of the Matrix fame and many other things. He's a very amusing character. And, you know, initially they're learning the ropes. You know, it's a sort of, it's a rough and ready, spit and sawdust kind of place. And, they start easing their way in. They do get lots of male attention. Some of it's okay. There's a guy, Toby, played by Toby Wallace, who we've just both seen in The Bike Riders, if you remember him as the young assailant, let's say. And he sort of takes them for a sort of dip in a kind of, was it like a...
A billabong. Isn't that billabong?
Yeah, there you go. Billabong, mate. And, you know, so they go on okay with him. But there's a really creepy fellow as well called Dolly, played by Daniel Henshaw. And he's really... really creepy. And, you know, these are all just patrons in the bar. And, you know, tensions begin to rise between the girls and the patrons. And I suppose if you've ever seen the classic Aussie outback thriller Wake in Fright, it's got that kind of vibe going on. I should also add it's directed by Kitty Green, who made, with Julia Garner, made The Assistant, which was the film kind of inspired by the whole Weinstein affair, where, you know, in terms of his what he did at Miramax and the Weinstein Company. It's Kitty reuniting with Julia Garner, which is good to see them back together. Yeah, I have to say, I enjoyed it. I did think it was quite predictable where it was going, and I am normally useless at figuring out where plots are going, but this time I was like, yeah, I can see where this one's heading. But I still enjoyed it, I have to say.
Yeah, it follows on from The Assistant because it is very much about power dynamics and the sort of ways women have to operate in the world in order to not piss off certain guys, and how you compromise what you're prepared to do and how you go about your business, and the sort of apologeticness that comes with that for asking to not be subjected to unwanted attention. And I'm interested that you say that Toby Wallace, who's a great actor, he is fantastic in Bike Riders, really holds his own in a fantastic cast there, and is really good here. You say he's a nice guy. He's not a nice guy, James.
I must admit, I've just remembered the bit early on where he's drunk and trying to get off with the Hannah character, isn't it?
Well, it's not even that. It begins straight away. And this is what I find really interesting. It's like, maybe you didn't notice that that was not okay, but it was not okay to me how he even entered the bar and what he first did. Absolutely not okay, and this film just made me feel incredibly uncomfortable throughout because I recognized everything in it. And from that point of view, it's a thriller, but it isn't a thriller in as much as it's asking you to predict the ending. As you say, there isn't really any huge big reveal. It's more a thriller for me in as much as this is very uncomfortable viewing because it's so recognizable, and every man in that building is a predator in some way, whether they mean to or not.
That's the key thing, is it? I mean, funny enough, I guess we'll revisit this conversation when we get onto How to Have Sex in a minute.
Yes, indeed.
You're right. I think by, well, obviously I mentioned the Dolly character being very creepy, and quite early on when there's a sort of drunken night going on upstairs, he suddenly appears upstairs. I mean, I kind of think he lives in that somewhere around that bar. He's in one of the rooms because obviously it is a hotel. So he's just sort of prowling around at night. And that was the point where I started to think, oh God, this is getting creepy. But yeah, I suppose you could say from a male point of view that early bar activity might just be seen as, I don't know, high jinks or something.
Yeah.
Whereas as clearly from a female point of view, you're on high alert, basically. Yeah. Sadly, that probably is the difference between men and women, isn't it? In the sense of, you know, men don't necessarily view all of their behavior as, you know, predatory or potentially disturbing. You know, as you say, they're not necessarily meaning to be, but there's always that potential, I suppose, isn't there? And I guess that's what the film, I mean, you know, there's some really disturbing sequences later on, which we won't go into, but, you know, again, that's the point where you go, oh, this is going really bad.
Yes, yeah. I mean, there is overt action, but equally so much that is unsaid, and is the expectations of these girls and how they behave in that bar. And, you know, even, you know, the lady that's constantly in the bar, who you would hope would be an ally, was like, you know, lean over when you give them a drink, girls, you know, like, please sexualize yourself, your role in the world. And in this world in particular, in this hyper masculine world where everyone's a blow-in as they're called, people who are escaping something. And also there's this thing as well, you feel even more sort of protective of them, because when somebody actually asks one of the girls, why did you come here? She says, it was the furthest away. And you sense that they're escaping something already. And the fact that you said, you know, they say they're Canadian, but are they? You sense that they're on the run from something. And so they never talk about what it is. We don't know anything about their background, how they became friends, where they have come from. And it's murky as to whether they're Canadian or American, but this sense that they've, something bad has already happened to them. And here they are in just the worst place possible if something awful has happened. I thought that was really clever and really interesting. And I hope it's thought-provoking to all members of audience, because it does make you think about social situations and social interactions and how it's perceived by other people, and that hijinks, as you say, or having a bit of a laugh, having some fun, mate, isn't necessarily fun to the person on the receiving end of it.
They have been dropped into this kind of, well, not entirely all male environment. Like you said, there's a couple of females. There's the woman at the bar that you mentioned. There's also the cook, who kind of is their protector, I think, most of all. In fact, the protector of everything, because she's sort of, she's trying to keep the Hugo Weaving character in line as well. But yeah, it's a sort of, you know, 95% masculine environment, and an environment where there's hardly any other women around. So it's probably about the worst environment you could drop two, you know, potentially damaged young, you know, girls who are partial to the odd drink as well. It's like, oh my God, this is potentially a toxic mess, basically.
Yeah, and I mean, it comes up as well, like, issues of consent are very prominent in this. Like, it is absolutely okay to want to kiss a man. It's absolutely okay to go a little bit to the next step with a man. And it's also absolutely okay to not want to continue and to not want to sleep with that man. So that's addressed. And I think we'll talk about consent in the next film as well. But I thought that was really cleverly done. Basically, it feels like a film you could show your teenage son and have a really good conversation about the various incidents and like how things are perceived and where lines should be drawn. You know, even in the way that Hugo Weaving, you mentioned, very first thing he says to them, he calls them a word that is, you know, they say, oh, perhaps it's cultural. It's a cultural difference. But to the Judy Garner character, it's the worst thing she could be called. And it conveys a sexual violence in it. So it's just really interesting. And the nuances and the different levels that are at play here, I just think it's really, really interesting.
I haven't really read much from Kitty Green about the film as to why the genesis of this project and what made her want to go to Australia and kind of create this, as you say, drama about consent in the middle of the outback. It's quite an unusual idea. So I'd like to read more just to see what she's got to say about it.
It's the sort of thing that you can imagine being in headlines as well, you know, two girls. And the thing that happens at the end, the thing I kept thinking was like, oh, this would be on a local news report. And like, it just does feel like it's from headlines. And it probably is an experience that a lot of backpacking young women might have experienced when they're jobbing around the world. It's also part of that thing as well, that they're itinerant workers. And so they're, nobody cares on that level either. They are blow-ins themselves, so that no one really cares. And then like where they are on the pecking order with, you know, there's, you know, an aspect of Aboriginal racism as well in the film. Everybody is picking on someone in the pecking order. That is just really very nicely done. So yeah, I would highly recommend this one. I think it's really good and will create a lot of conversation in the pub after.
Yeah, I did also spend quite a lot of the time looking at Julia Garner. I think you're sort of lamenting the fact that Madonna biopic that Madonna was going to direct, obviously about her own life, and Garner was supposed to be the actress who'd been through all the rehearsals to play Madonna. And you know, you just look at her and think, God, she's a kind of a dead ringer for young Madonna on some level. And I'm sure she could have done the singing and dancing and all that stuff brilliantly. But yeah, it was really sad that, at least at the moment, doesn't seem to be happening, because I think she would have been fantastic in that.
Yeah, she's a great actress. Why did that fall apart? Madonna just pulled the plug, didn't she?
Well, she's on a mega hits tour, isn't she?
Yeah, she's busy doing that. Maybe she'll come back around to it. Anyway, if you want to see a very sort of interesting and nuanced film about consent and everything else, and the basically relationships between men and women, this is The Royal Hotel, and it is out in cinemas on Friday. From toxic males down under to toxic males on holes. It's this one now.
All right, do us a favour and wake Tara up.
And she yours.
Not in yours.
my mum's life, I'm not joking.
I just look proper, yeah?
Where have you been?
Best holiday ever.
So this is How to Have Sex, James. This is a trio of girls in Malia, and they want to get laid. That's what they keep saying. But where does that lead?
So they basically just finished their GCSEs. I think they're waiting for their results. They're all at that stage in life of, well, you know, where are we going to go next? You know, that's hovering in the back of their minds. You know, they're really good friends. You've got Tara, played by Mia McKenna-Bruce. She's the lead. Then Sky, played by Lara Peake, and M, played by Enver Lewis. And yeah, like I say, they're all good mates. They're just out to have time in one of these kind of, I think once upon a time you'd call it an 18 to 30 holiday. Mm-hmm. I think these days that is not a phrase that's used anymore, but it's that kind of thing. They're just out to go and get wasted, basically.
Yeah.
And yeah, they achieved that pretty well, just like everyone else in the background to the film. But, you know, they meet some guys who are in their sort of the adjacent room in their sort of holiday complex that they're staying in. You've got Badger, who's a bit of a kind of lovable, I think I've seen the phrase doofus used about him, which I thought was quite funny.
Well, but they call him a clown themselves, yeah, don't they?
And he's a sweet guy in a way. He's played by Sean Thomas, which I just realised.
The kid from The Gentle Giant.
Selfish Giant. Yes. But that was like 10 years ago. And you think, oh, right. Wow. That's where he's been. And it's fascinating to sort of put those two films together. You've got Badger and his mate, Paddy, played by Samuel Bottomley. And of course, there's flirtation between the, you know, the girls and the guys. I think, you know, initially Badger takes a shine to Tara. But, you know, he's not as much of a, you know, lady killer, let's say, as Paddy. And, yeah, it ends up after, you know, another sort of drunken night, Paddy and Tara do end up on the beach. And then, you know, I probably won't say too much more from there, but you then start to get flashbacks from what happened on that night. You know, Tara's having to process everything, basically, and what happened that evening. It's... you know, very subtly done from writer-director Molly Manning-Walker, who's making a feature debut here. She also shot, as a cinematographer, she shot Scrapper, which you might remember from a few weeks ago, came
Love
out
it.
In the UK. Yeah, that's one of my favourites this year, actually. Yeah, now she's made the leap to directing and writing with this film. It goes on from there as to sort of how Tara processes what on earth has happened to her in the last few hours under this kind of haze of, you know, drink and, you know, the lights of the enormous sort of clubs that they're in. You know, everyone's seen that. If you think about the in-betweeners, for example, and the kind of places they went to, it's a bit like that, but just done in a much more documentary style.
Yeah. I mean, I used to watch Ibiza Uncovered every single week. I loved that show. And this is very much like a narrative version of Ibiza Uncovered. One of the key things about Tara is she's a virgin and she finds this incredibly shameful that at this age in her life, she hasn't lost her virginity. And so she's on this holiday with her friends and her hope is to lose that. And she is absolutely adamant that that's what she wants. They are young girls that are dressing in very revealing clothes. They are having a good time and, you know, in a promiscuous atmosphere. But what's really interesting about this film for me is that what you think you want and what you actually want are very often two different things when you're a teenager and when you're trying to find your way through life. The idea of peer pressure and the idea of social pressure and what you think you should have done by a certain age when you're a teenager. I mean, anyone can understand that feeling of thinking, well, I haven't done that yet. And has everyone done that? Am I really behind because I haven't done this or I haven't done that? So Tara is this, she's loud and gobby and fun, and she thinks she absolutely is in control of her needs and her wants. And then when she finds she's close to those needs and wants, it's actually really quite alarming. There's a really key scene in a club and they're all doing drinking games and they're all very sexual drinking games. And she suddenly realizes that within this world, she is actually quite a little girl. And this is alarming to her. And from there, the film sort of veers in a totally different direction to where you think it is going from the beginning. And so, yeah, again, this was another one that I just thought, you could just show this to your teenage kids and have a really interesting conversation. As we mentioned before, consent is a huge part of it. it's perfectly okay for girls to go out, have a good time, get drunk, wear revealing clothing, kiss boys, and also to say no. And that is very important and very interesting in this film, and the weird grey areas and the blurred lines of that and how that makes you feel. Yeah, another just really clever film by a female filmmaker that's really got inside the skin of a teenage, well, a young woman's experience, like The Royal Hotel. I watched this through my fingers most of the time because not only was it sort of emotionally fraught, but just watching them drink as much as they did and throwing up and then immediately necking another bottle of vodka, I felt sick watching it. And that's the point. You know exactly that feeling where you're like, oh, hair of the dog, get back on it. So yeah, I just think it really captures that age really, really well.
Yeah, and it's, well, I mentioned the word documentary earlier. Obviously, it's not a documentary, but it has that kind of loose feel, the camera work. You know, I think a lot of it's been shot handheld and, you know, the dialogue's very naturalistic. You feel like these guys, well, obviously they're not long-term friends, the boys and the girls, because they've just met, but they immediately slip into a very easy, casual shorthand, I suppose you could say. You know, they, as you say, it captures that contemporary adolescence, I suppose you'd put it, extremely well. Yeah, all the performances are really, you know, sort of note perfect. There's not really a weak link among them. I mean, obviously, Mia McKenna Bruce, who is the lead.
She was in Tracy Beaker.
I don't even know what Tracy Beaker is, so you'll have to fill me in on that one. Right. Well, obviously, she's gone from that to How to Have Sex. But as you say, even though she's sort of playing this, you know, little girl in some ways, who's suddenly realizing that she's in this highly sexualized atmosphere, it's a very confident performance, if that makes any sense. It's like, you know, it's perfectly modulated by Mia, and really very impressive. But all of them are really good as well. I know from speaking to the director when they were on set, they had all of the conversations that I suppose you would want your teenage children or your friends, if you were just going to the cinema to see it, to have. They had all those consent conversations on set. They obviously had, I suppose, counselors and sort of trauma people to talk to, because I think it was very affecting for all of them filming this movie. And you know, they did it in completely the right way. This bowed in Cannes, it was in the Uncertain Regard section, and it just went ballistic in Cannes. I mean, you couldn't get a ticket for love nor money, basically. And it ended up winning one of the prizes in the Uncertain Regard section. So it was kind of the hot film that everyone was talking about, and I think that buzz has continued, really, and deserves to, because like we were just saying with The Royal Hotel, it's asking some very important questions. You know, I think the director has pretty much stated she wants people to have a conversation about consent. You know, it's not just about yes or no, there's all this kind of weird gray area stuff in between, and I guess that's where the trouble starts, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Also, I mean, I just think Mia McKenna-Bruce is like a little, it's like watching Lady Macbeth with Florence Pugh.
Oh, I thought you meant the actual Lady Macbeth from...
No.
right, you mean Lady Macbeth, the film by
the
William
Holroyd.
I
do. When we saw Florence Pugh and we saw this incredibly confident, angel-faced woman becoming a star. And I felt like that was the thing with Mia in this film. I felt like this performance is so beautifully done. The sort of emotional journey that she goes through is so, you know, beautifully done that it reminded me of Florence Pugh, and I thought this girl is going to go places. And also, when are they going to cast her and Florence Pugh as sisters, because they have a very similar sort of cute face. I also think Sean Thomas is really incredible in this, because he has this quite tricky role of, as you say, he's playing a clown, he's also a lad, but there's a softness to him, and he has to convey that through bravado, and he does that beautifully as well. He was also in Ali and Ava as well, as the son in that, so he's doing really well. Bradford lad, big up Bradford, love the accent that's going on there. That made me homesick, I like to hear that. So yeah, I think it's just a really great film.
I was just gonna say, it's interesting, just going back to a point you made earlier about peer pressure, and I was just curious to what you thought. I mean, her friends, as I said at the very beginning, are, I think, very supportive of her, and certainly in the final scene, which we won't talk about, but they're very, very supportive of her. But do you think they were pressuring her into sort of having sex along the way, or it's a sort of self-imposed pressure that she just feels because everyone else seems to have advanced, so to speak, and, you know, lost their virginity or whatever it might be.
I think it's really interesting. And actually, you bring up something that I did think was really good, was the weird dynamics between the girls, because it's a trio and one of the girls is extremely supportive throughout, absolutely her complete buddy. But one of the girls, there's a weird frenemy aspect to it. And I think that's really true to life as well, that sometimes you can have a friend who may not have your best interests at heart and actually may be jealous if you look like you may be catching up to them. There's a certain amount of sabotage that happens with this friend, very subtle sabotage. So I don't think they were pressuring her, but the fact that it does explore this idea that, you know, adolescents now talk very frankly about sex and, you know, are much more exposed to porn perhaps than previous generations. And so you do talk about making sure you look banging and that you're going to get laid and that you absolutely will get a dick. You were going to catch a dick tonight, that this is the sort of way that they talk. But actually, is it how they feel? And that's what the Tara character brings to the fore, that while you may be able to talk about that stuff and want that stuff, ultimately, you might not be ready for it. And yeah, just brilliantly done. Did you think that the friends were trying to sort of sabotage her a little bit?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, kind of. I didn't pick that up as well as you did, I don't think. But again, it wasn't overt pressure, but you just sense that, bearing in mind, we only really watched them on this, you know, week-long holiday or whatever it is, but you don't know what's gone on before and all of the stuff at school and all of the conversations they've had at school that's led her to get to this state of, you know, I must, you know, lose my virginity on holiday. I don't think they need to pressure her too much because that pressure's kind of always there.
Yeah, really. And it's coming from herself, yeah. And the lack of confidence, self-confidence, even though she's incredibly confident, there's a weird lack of self-confidence. Her, as she is not enough, that she needs to be this, that, and the other, and she needs to be throwing up over a bin and falling down with chips and everything else. That needs to be done. It's a rite of passage. And for many people, that is, and it's great fun. And for many people, they do all these things and have a lovely time. But this film does highlight that not everybody, that's a very happy experience.
Yeah. Did it make you want to go on holiday again, though, Jane?
I never want to do those holidays.
No. I've never done one of those holidays, I have to say. So,
yeah, the vodka drinking challenge, I think I'm done with that. Yeah, the drinking as soon as you get up, yeah, I think I'm done. I have fond memories of sort of the silly buggers that you do get up to on holiday. But also just really glad that I don't have to stay in hotels like that anymore, because you've got no money. You're staying in quite crap hotels and eating chips. That's basically your diet. So I prefer like a much quieter holiday these days, James.
Yes, yes. I also a quick shout out just to, you know, the team that put together all the club scenes as well, because they were, you know, all bathed in kind of neon blue lights and green and purples. And each time they were at a club, it had a sort of different feel, a different characteristic, which I think probably reflected her emotional journey, Tara's emotional journey through the film. And I thought they did that very authentically, given I think they were shooting out of season as well, with a bunch of extras they had to sort of round up and who were sort of, you know, freezing, you know, somewhere. It wasn't quite the balmy temperatures it's supposed to be. I thought they did a really good job of just recreating that atmosphere of a sort of hedonistic paradise.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, so if you fancy a bit of a hedonistic paradise, you might feel bilious in some parts of it. How to Have Sex is in cinemas from tomorrow. Okay, speaking of jumping in the sea, which our characters do in How to Have Sex, how about jumping into a big sea with sharks? It's this.
Everybody's got a little.
Diana Nyad,
world champion marathon swimmer.
The swim I want to do is 60 hours. That's Cuba to Florida.
Absolutely not. No, that's insane.
Diana, you tried that when you were 28, and you did not make it when you're 28. You're 60.
I don't believe in imposed limitations.
The only one who gets to decide if I'm through is me.
So this is Nyad. Who is Diane Nyad, James?
Diana Nyad, played by Annette Bening, is she's like a superwoman. This is like a true story. In her 20s, she was a sort of endurance swimmer. She tried several times to make the cross, or tried at least once to make the insane crossing between the Florida Keys and Cuba. That's about just over 100 miles, which is an insane distance when you think about that. But it would be insane in a swimming pool, probably, to do that, let alone in a rough sea with sharks and electric eels and all that kind of stuff. the film doesn't really start there. It starts when she is in her early 60s and she decides, you know, she can't let go of this challenge to make this swim. And she's kept herself in shape over the years, but not to the levels you need to do something like that. But she decides she's going to raise the money. She's going to recruit her friend Bonnie, played by Jodie Foster, to be her coach. And she's going to get out there and she's going to conquer that distance, basically do exactly the same trip. And it's really about her efforts to try and make this crossing. It's one of those, it's obviously out in the public domain what happened.
Yes.
I'm not sure if we want to say, just it's worth keeping that as a surprise. I remember I talked about this the last time I was on because I'd just seen it. And you said at the time, how can you make a film about where effectively, you know, swimming is quite a repetitive thing.
Yeah.
It's just stroke after stroke after stroke, which is what, you know, she does. But how can you make a film that's interesting about that? And I thought the guys that made it, they succeeded, basically. Again, a bit like the clubbing scenes just now in How to Have Sex, each one had its own characteristic. Each time she goes in the water, let's say, each journey has its own characteristic in this film, which keeps it interesting. You've got, you know, some added people on her team, particularly Rhys Ifans, who plays this kind of gruff, almost Quint from Jaws, like,
yeah,
navigator, who I think that's one of Ifans' best performances in a long time. He was just perfectly cast in this. But I think more than anything, what drives it, aside from an absolutely fantastic performance by Benning, is the character of Nyad herself, who is like insanely devoted to this task, this quest, more than anybody I've seen. I mean, she's very, very self-absorbed, you know, at the cost of everyone around her. It's all about her achievement. But that, for me, made it completely compelling. It was such a sort of brilliant character-driven study of ambition that, yeah, I fell for it, hook, line. To use a nautical metaphor.
Yeah, I see what you've done there.
Hook, line, and sinker.
I mean, for me, the swimming was secondary, really, to, as you say, this very interesting performance by Annette Bening, who I fully expect to be in a sort of final five alongside Emma Stone for Poor Things and Lily Gladstone for Killers of the Flower Moon. We wait to see who else might be in there.
Carey Mulligan for Maestro.
Possibly, yes, indeed. It's an amazing performance, and she has been so close to getting awards and an Oscar from numerous performances in the past, and it feels like this would be the one that people will award her for it, possibly because she hasn't been awarded in the past. But that aside, she does brilliant. Sort of basically, Nyad is this main character energy. That's her entire thing, isn't she? She's purely about herself. And the fact that Benning can do that without being a dick, basically, you still like her, despite the fact that she's incredibly self-absorbed. But the main thing for me is the relationship between her and Bonnie. And I just loved everything about that. I found it delicious whenever they were chatting. From the very start, you absolutely believe this friendship. And these two older women, gay women, who have dated for a millisecond and are now really close friends. And I thought, I don't know that I've seen that essayed brilliantly on screen before. You know, two gay best friends who feel entirely lived in, entirely real. Their relationship, I absolutely believe their frustrations with each other, totally believe. You know, this very beginning that you see with them is, it's Nyad's birthday and she's like, don't do a party. And then a party is thrown and Bonnie says, well, I knew that you did want a party. And, you know, like, just the real connection they have with each other is amazing. And I just love watching Jodie Foster. I forget how much I enjoy seeing her on screen because she hasn't been on screen for a while. And she's buff, isn't she? Super buff in this. It's like Jodie's been really down the gym. So she's like this really strong woman physically and emotionally. And that was the big draw for me. The swimming was secondary.
Yeah, I mean, Foster, like Benning, this is just one of her strongest performances in a long time. I mean, I assume it's true that they did date for a millisecond, like you said, back in the day. But it's really good in terms of the narrative just to get that out of the way.
Yeah.
Because we know, okay, fine, they're not interested in each other in any other way beyond friendship. But what a friendship, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a friendship built on whatever it is, 40-odd years of loving each other, winding each other up, but they'd never be apart in the end. They are lifelong friends. And it is a fantastic portrait of friendship, basically. And, I mean, you're right, the swimming is secondary. But it's the plot's driving factor, obviously.
Yes, of course.
What's going on. But you wouldn't have one without the other in the end, I guess. I mean, you could have a portrait of them hanging out you know, like that opening scene, that would be kind of interesting to watch them hang out. But obviously the extremes that they go to with this endurance swim makes it, you know, they put their friendship to breaking point, basically.
Yes.
More than once.
And also the fact that, you know, nobody achieves a goal like this without that huge support, that ride or die that makes you believe that you can do it. And the person who's willing to say, I think you need to take care of yourself as well. You know, the person that's willing to say the thing that you don't want to hear, just think it's great. So do we think Jodie Foster might also be in the awards conversation as well with this performance?
Yeah, I absolutely don't see why not. Of course, she'd be in the supporting category, yes. I would imagine. But I can't really think who else right now would be going into that category. But she would have to be there, I would have thought.
I would have thought Jodie Comer in Bike Riders might be in a supporting actress category.
The Comer one is interesting because...
is she lead or is she support?
Yeah, it could go either way. And probably for her sake, it might be better to go into the supporting category. I mean, she is also fantastic in the Bike Riders. So the work that she's been doing, Comer, this
amazing.
Is over the last few years, outstanding. So yeah, it's about time she was in that Kodak Theatre, basically.
Yes, indeed. So I think we're saying Naiad is also definitely worth your time.
It's a strong week, really. It's a very strong week. I mean, we started with Fingernails, which is a very solid film. And well, I think it feels like we've got better and better, basically.
Okay. So if you fancy Naiad, it is on Netflix from Friday. Shall we see if we're going to keep going then with this quality? It's the first rule of Fight Club now. It's this.
Could the ugly, untalented gays please report to the principal's office?
Guess that's you guys.
Tonight is our night. We're getting the cooch.
I'm gonna talk to Brittany.
You could say hi to Isabel.
What would I say?
Hey, girl, how's your boyfriend?
How's his penis? Mirror, mirror
on the wall. I'm gonna expel you both
for committing a crime against
Jeff. Get out of the car.
You can't tell me what to do.
Get out of the freaking car!
We were just practicing for a self-defense club.
So it's like a fight club?
Yes.
Just stay in your lane until you're munching Beaver at Wesleyan.
Yes, sir.
So this is Bottoms. James, have you seen this one?
I have not seen this, unfortunately. So please fill me in and you can try and entice me into the cinema.
Do you know anything about it?
I don't, actually. I am a complete Bottoms newbie.
So it sounds a bit raunchy, and you'd be right, it is a little bit raunchy. This is a high school comedy about two girls who are best friends. Best friends are a theme this podcast. Rachel Sennett plays PJ, and her bestie is played by Ayo Edebiri, who plays Josie. And they are two, you know, this the school calls them talentless ugly gays. They are two lesbian friends who just really would like to have a snog with the beautiful cheerleaders, wouldn't we all? And the cheerleaders are sort of led by Kaya Gerber. She's a model, but she had a bit part in her Babylon. She was the starlet in that. She is sort of heading up this gang of beautiful girls who are all going out with the jock boys. It's a weird world, like we talked about with Fingernails. It's a world where cell phones don't seem to exist. People listen to Sony Discmans. Fashion is all sort of non-specifically era related. It's an otherworld place. But during this time, they get into a scrap with one of the football stars, and they tell the principal, well, we were just practicing for our fight club. And the principal says, okay, is that a club you're going to do? You can do that. And so they start this ridiculous club, basically to get out of being bollocked by the school principal, where they invite girls in the school to self-defense classes. But it's actually just an opportunity to kick the shit out of each other. And that spirals from a sort of teenage girl fight club to possible romantic entanglements with the cheerleaders. It's sweary. It's raunchy. It's saucy. You know, it's Rachel Sennett. You know what you're getting if she's in a film. And I really quite enjoyed it. Do you fancy it, James?
I do like a high school teen movie. I mean, I remember from a few years back, you were a big fan of Booksmart.
And this is nearly Booksmart. It's almost Booksmart. It's not as heartfelt as that. It's not as clever as that. It's a lot more sort of down the Animal House end of a Booksmart thing, should we say. But it's got a massively sort of banging soundtrack by Charlie XCX. How do we say that? XCX? Is that how do we just say that?
Yeah, we'll go with that. I mean,
I'm not down with the kids, but it's got this great soundtrack. It's got high school boys banging moms, Mrs. Robinson styley. Got a terrible sort of teachers that are just awful. It's not remotely realistic. So it's, what's interesting about this is these girls also want to lose their virginity to other girls. So the premise is quite similar to How to Have Sex, but the delivery is entirely different. And it's very much more about raunchy laughs and being very comedically wide. It's a very different animal, but the outcome is sort of similar in as much as what you want and what you actually need might be two different things. So there is a little bit of heart to it, but yeah, it's not up there with Booksmart.
As you mentioned, it's got these kind of female friendships being something of the theme of the week, really.
Yep.
And you wonder if you sort of look at the meetings that the various distributors that have and go, well, when are we going to date our films? And then one of them dates it. And then do you think another one goes, well, let's just hop on that bandwagon? It seems like an odd thing that they've all ended up in the same week.
I think these things just do actually happen organically. But this is a satire, I would say. And it's a satire about high school. It's a satire about violence. It's a satire about sexuality. It is not meant to be taken seriously in a very different way than How to Have Sex is. It's bonkers and very silly. And if you want a good time, it would be a very different good time you'd have at the cinema seeing this than it would be for the Royal Hotel or How to Have Sex. You're not going to probably have very deep and meaningful conversations about it. You might discuss which bits you like best and could you believe that that joke went that far, but you're probably not going to have a discussion about consent.
But you're not suggesting a treble bill with the Royal Hotel, How to Have Sex? And
I would actually, bottoms. Because I think they interestingly all deal with very similar themes, but in very different ways. So I think it would be quite a good weekend of movies if you went and saw all three of those.
That's it. I got my weekend sorted then.
Okay. Yeah. And also I think Kaia Gerber, who is the daughter of Cindy Crawford, is rather good in it. She's playing this vapid cheerleader called Brittany, who is never knowingly not wearing clothes that show off various parts of her body. And she's rather sweet in it. So yeah, I think we might be seeing more of her. And I love Rachel Sennett. Love her in anything. And the banter between her and her friend is really quite zingy and funny. And yeah, I love it. Yeah, I'd highly recommend this one as well. It's out in cinemas on Friday. That's it, James, for this week. Which one are you going for your film of the week? If you have to watch one, which one will it be?
It's really tough, actually, because they're all good in different ways. I think I'm going to go for Naiad just because I really enjoyed those performances from Foster and Benning, but with a, you know, slight caveat that obviously How to Have Sex, well, not obviously, but How to Have Sex is an extraordinary piece of work as well. But I'm going to go for Naiad.
I'm going to go for How to Have Sex with a side order of bottoms.
Excellent.
That's what I suggest. Okay, so before we go, we should say that if you do like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Then you don't have to look for it. It just appears for you. And to say that next week we have a new issue out. All will be revealed soon. But let's just say it's going to rev up your life. Before we go, we have time for a listener's question. So, James, what is your favourite use of a gardening implement in films?
Must say, I slightly struggled with this and had
really?
To...
Really? There's yeah, so many!
I know, and I just couldn't think of any. I solicited advice from a friend, and she said the shears in Hot Fuzz, but it's so long since I've seen Hot Fuzz, I can't actually remember that sequence. So in the end, I've decided on two. Well, just because it's one of the greatest films of all time, there's a spade in Goodfellas where they're digging the... they're putting Billy Bats in the ground. I mean, that's a garden implement.
And then
perhaps more the secateurs. I just wanted to say the word secateurs. The secateurs in Master Gardener, the Paul Schrader film, which are very menacing, if you remember.
I do, yeah, yes. I'm going to go for an obvious one, but one that was a goodie. Ridiculously named Tyler Rake in Extraction 1 and 2. Dispatchers with a rake. Well, actually, in one with a rake and in two with a gardening fork. And I enjoy that they fully accept that his name is ridiculous and therefore he should dispatch people with something that represents his name. But also, I think we should put a shout out for a chainsaw in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You'd use that for your arborealist.
Lopping off branches.
Yeah,
kind of
you know, bollarding trees. I think that's what it's called when you make him into like that ball thing, but used with absolutely terrifying effect in Texas Chainsaw Massacre when he is wheeling that thing around with that horrible mask on and she is running down that road at the end of a truly terrifying night. Shivers. It makes me feel all funny now, even thinking of it.
I did think about the lawnmower man as well. Obviously, there is a lawnmower in that. That's an excellent garden implement. So.
Also, a lawnmower used nearly shaves off Keanu's face in Point Break during that scuffle with the surfers where Anthony Kiedis gets a bullet in the toe. There's a lawnmower used there. I mean, there's plenty of garden.
You're right. You see, once you've opened
once you start, you can't stop.
Pandora's box of garden implements.
Yeah, I mean, has anyone been dispatched with a hoe? That feels like that would be quite a useless weapon because it's quite small at the end. You could prod someone with a hoe quite effectively, but yeah, you really need a spade, don't you? So on that note, anyway, we will go and think of some more gardening implement, but until we see you next week, we will have to say goodbye. So say goodbye, James.
Bye.
Goodbye.